From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Robert J. Lifton listens to President Bush describe the war on terror, he listens, first of all, not as a strategist, but as a psychiatrist. And what this psychiatrist hears today is the sound of America being drawn into an apocalyptic confrontation with the world. He sees a wounded, humiliated superpower worked into a righteous lather, ready to purge the world of evil through violence. Some call it national defense. Lifton calls it the superpower syndrome, and he sees it dangerously twinned with an equally apocalyptic Islamic foe, with each side intent on ridding the world of evil personified by the other. Do you see the United States in the grip of a crusading psychosis, or just a superpower trying to defend itself? Can understanding the psychology of violence offer a solution that military means cannot? And is the American psyche locked in apocalyptic showdown mode, or just taking care of difficult business? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Robert J. Lifton, visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. His new book is Superpower Syndrome, America's Apocalyptic Confrontation with the World. Good evening and welcome, Professor Lifton.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us in the studio tonight is Randall Kennedy, On Point News analyst and professor of law at Harvard University. Good to have you, Randall.
Thank you so much.
So, Robert J. Lifton, the superpower syndrome. You say that there's much more here than we hear in the words of the leaders, or perhaps we have to listen more carefully than we might naturally listen. You're looking this as someone who's been involved with politics for a long time, who's watched geopolitics for a long time, but you're looking at it as a psychiatrist. And what is it that you see? Where's the apocalypse here?
Well, apocalyptic violence means an impulse to destroy the world or much of the world, always in the service of renewal, in the service of purification. It's pretty obvious with someone like bin Laden that there's an apocalyptic dimension. He wants just about everything destroyed in order to be recreated in a perfect Islamist fashion.
The kind of all-consuming Islamic perfection, as you put it.
That's right, or Islamist in the
Islamist
sense of being
yes.
fundamentalist and far from, you know, all of Islam. That apocalyptic tendency is much less immediately visible with the United States because we present ourselves as rational, secular people who are attempting to maintain national security in a dangerous world. But I feel we've fallen into what I call a superpower syndrome, which really means a sense of entitlement to dominate the world, a sense that one can act unilaterally, and a sense that because one is the dominant military power, one has the right to full American hegemony in the world. And it's not just my idea. It's written in some of our documents, including the National Security Strategy document of 2002.
So there's the apocalyptic impulse. You say 9/11 acted as the trigger to set this off, that it set off a series of psychological responses that in some ways, as you describe it, as I hear it, are unique to a superpower.
Yes, that's right. I mean, 9/11 was a dreadful event. It was, in Nuremberg terms, a crime against humanity. But our response to 9/11 has been problematic. And yes, there were plans for superpower dominance long before 9/11, but 9/11 released those plans and brought them into the center of action so that one could say that there were impulses toward superpower syndrome, well, from at least the time of the end of World War II when we emerged a dominant world power, and certainly intensified with the end of the Cold War in the late 80s and early 90s when we were the only remaining superpower. But with this George W. Bush administration, that superpower syndrome has had a quantum jump and into dangerous areas.
But the syndrome you describe, behind all the strength that is obvious in the superpower, is a kind of vulnerability. Take us into the psychology. When the superpower is challenged, as you see it, what's the kind of sequence of psychological events, as you see it? What's the landscape of the national psyche that can then be harnessed to this apocalyptic vision again, as you say?
Well, it's ironic because here, the dominant military power on Earth turns out to be very vulnerable and constantly in fear of its own vulnerability, of its own weakness. And that is because, I believe, a superpower seeks omnipotence. It's not a logical process. If it's a superpower, it's a more than natural power, and it includes a sense that we have the right to be the strongest and the dominant power, but it's impossible to sustain that omnipotence. It's our fantasy. I mean, bin Laden has his fantasy about a perfect Islamist world. We have our fantasy about the control of history, or what I call fluid world control. So we're constantly on the lookout for our vulnerability, whether it's through other nations acquiring weapons of mass destruction or through spreading our troops too thin throughout the world. The goal, the unstated goal of absolute dominance and omnipotence is unachievable, and it leaves us, ironically, as perhaps the most fearful of all world powers.
I want to look more at that, but I wonder if it's really unstated and if it's really unrealistic. Just an hour ago, President Bush was on television talking about Muammar Gaddafi, saying he's put down his weapons of mass destruction program, whatever that may be. And the president said, I'll quote him here, he said, "In word and in action, we have clarified the choices left to potential adversaries." As in, end of story. They know what they have to do. We've laid down the law. Libya has now come into compliance with the law. The president might say, Robert J. Lifton, it's a dangerous world. We're doing what has to be done, and it's working.
I'm sure the president would say something like that or worse to me, but or to someone who has the views that I do. And yes, it is a dangerous world. The difficulty is that the theory that he's operating on and that the administration is operating on is that you make the world less dangerous by absolute domination. The problem is that absolute domination is impossible, and it comes apart in various ways. And the he says he's making the world safer for Americans and in general, but the current policies that we're following tend to intensify the motivation for terrorism and increase terrorism. So he makes this announcement today, but there are announcements apparently coming from al-Qaeda to the effect that they are to pursue a holy war in Iraq. Iraq was under the control of a murderous dictator before we invaded it.
Yes.
But it was a relatively peaceful place otherwise.
Unless you were in the meat grinder.
Yes, of course. But now it's an area of potential apocalyptic confrontation. And there are the Islamist impulse toward a holy war and our impulse toward reconstituting Iraq in our own image.
I think we better take another minute and look at this apocalyptic impulse. You say it has deep roots in human history, the human psyche. It goes way back. Give us a sense of where this came from, this sense. In some ways, it's a very early form of burning the village in order to save it. This idea of purging everything to start anew, what are the roots? You say it's in Christianity, Judaism, Islam. How far back does it go?
It seems that all major religions have some sort of apocalyptic story. And the story is that God or some supernatural force found it necessary to destroy the world because it was going in wrong directions in order to purify it. The Judeo-Christian story seems to be the most concrete. It's interesting that when I studied Om Shinrikyo, the fanatical Japanese cult that released sarin gas
in the subway a few years ago.
Yes, in 95. Mm-hmm. They were mostly Buddhist and somewhat Hindu, but they adopted the Armageddon narrative because it's the most concrete.
That is the Bible's narrative.
Yes, the first Judaic and then the Christian Bible, because that narrative is most concrete with a battle between good and evil and a victory that turns the world into total purity.
And what's the psychology here, the human yearning to be cleared of all this corruption and all this woe and have a fresh beginning, even if it takes a bloodbath to clear the way?
That's a lot of it. You know, we are the creatures who know that we die, and we like our deaths to have some profound significance, and all the more so collectively. So it's an appealing narrative. It's an idealistic narrative to say that if one is collectively serving the purification of the world, then one's own life and death have some profound meaning, and it has to do with human desires to find a spiritual purity of one's own in one's own life, and also to be part of something that is eternal.
But in human history, as you describe it, humans looked to God to unleash that armor, that apocalypse, because they didn't have the power themselves. In the 20th century, they began to have the sense that they might themselves have that power.
Absolutely. And nuclear weapons change everything, because prior to that, it was only God who could destroy the world. Nuclear weapons now enable us to realize that we are capable of destroying the world with our own technology. And we can do what only God could do before. That's one reason why we often worship nuclear weapons, because we render them deities, since only a deity could destroy the world, and any self-respecting deity could recreate it as well.
So when President Bush said 3 days after 9/11, our responsibility to history is already clear to answer these attacks and rid the world of evil, your ears perked up.
Oh, absolutely. Because what we now have is a combination of a kind of military fundamentalism, the idea of solving problems by military rather than nonviolent means, and that has to do with American hegemony and world control. But tied in with that is an element and influence of Christian fundamentalism, which divides the world into good and evil and sees the battle against what we call terrorism, or people we label terrorists, as a form of ridding the world of evil. And that can take on an apocalyptic dimension, because one reaches all over for terrorists. And finally, you know, bin Laden and Saddam Hussein become interchangeable, and it's part of the, quotes, war against terrorism, which can take us anywhere.
Bin Laden and Saddam Hussein become interchangeable in their attraction to apocalyptic thinking. At some level, I see you saying even the United States and the Islamists, I don't know about interchangeable, but as you describe it, both apocalyptic. There's much more I want to get into here, but Randall Kennedy, I want to bring you in. Are you drawn to this view of an apocalyptic standoff, the United States playing with apocalypse to rid the world of evil, or is this a president dealt a tough hand and aggressively responding as best he can?
I think that Dr. Lifton's thesis is certainly provocative, and he provides a very frightening portrayal of things. I think, though, that American leaders, and I think it would be a mistake to view George Bush as the only leader worth talking about. Obviously, he's important. He's calling the shots, but there are a lot of other people. And even George Bush is aware of the limits of American power. We can see that with Iraqification. I think this is an interesting thesis, but my own sense is that it's itself tinged with a bit of apocalyptic. It's an apocalyptic view of the apocalyptic imagination. I don't think we are in as bad a shape as Dr. Lifton portrays us being.
That is not so much in the grip of an apocalyptic, wounded, humiliated urge to destroy, to
no,
see the world reborn.
No, I think that there is considerable, I think there's a lot more just old-fashioned pragmatism that is in play. It's pragmatism with a military, with a military face on it. But of course, we are facing people who themselves put on a military face.
Robert J. Lifton, where's the cue to you that this is not just a pragmatic response with a military face, but something deeper?
Well, for instance, if you read carefully through the book about Bush's first 100 days.
Bob Woodward's book,
Bush at War. And he's not one prone to irony. It's a book pretty much that defends Bush as a great hero. But he says Bush sees himself as following God's master plan. That's Woodward's words. And Bush often asserts his calling to destroy evil and to rid the world of evil. But, you know, this apocalyptic impulse doesn't rule out elements of pragmatism. You've got one of the world's most pragmatic men sitting in the White House in the body of Karl Rove. And also, people who have zealous, extreme impulses can also step back and adapt and be pragmatic. You can watch our interaction with, say, North Korea.
But look at the underlying psychology you're saying. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back with Robert J. Lifton. We're talking tonight about the superpower syndrome and one psychiatrist's warning of a new American urge to apocalypse. Do you buy Robert J. Lifton's diagnosis? Do you feel the United States in the grip of a crusading psychosis? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton and about his warning of a new American urge to apocalypse. His new book is Superpower Syndrome, America's Apocalyptic Confrontation with the World. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you feel the United States in the grip of a crusading psychosis? Is it an aggrieved superpower lashing out at the world, or just a superpower defending itself? Has George Bush put the nation and the world on a path to apocalyptic purification, or is he simply dealing with a lethal threat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. On Point News analyst Randall Kennedy joins us tonight as well. Right now, Ralph is calling from Boston. Hi, Ralph. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I would disagree. I do not believe that it is an apocalypse, and I would state that simply if we look at 9/11, the statement left behind by those people, those terrorists, was that they wanted to kill us and kill every one of us, man, woman, and child, and that rather than being an apocalyptic view, it's basically Bush was dealt a hand that said, geez, I didn't deal with this, or I didn't get the opportunity to deal with this problem soon enough, and I should do so now. And rather than apocalyptic, I would say that he's moralistic, and I admire him for his moralism. That is that, you know, anybody who harbors or supports terrorism is our enemy. And while I would say that it is true that it is unlikely that Saddam had any ties directly to al-Qaeda, it is not true that he did not have ties directly to terrorists. He paid people who were suicide bombers in Israel, for example.
And Ralph, let me ask you something. Where do you see then in the war on terror, in this justified response that you see, where do you see the end?
I don't see an end. Unfortunately, I don't. I think that it is true that there are problems that develop when you go into Iraq, but I think that the problems are only part of the overall problem of the world. That is that I think that the world, that is the Europeans in general, are weak-kneed. And I believe that there are forces aligned against us, and that's not necessarily apocalyptic, but realistic as to what's going on. I see
it. Ralph, we've got it. I want to put it to Robert J. Lifton. Thank you very much for your call. Robert J. Lifton, your response? You must hear this. You must know this is
sure,
a common line of response to your critique.
Look, I respect the caller's concern about a moral position on the part of the president. I want a president who has a moral position toward the world as well. The difficulty is that this form of moralism tends to polarize the world and tends to create more terrorism rather than reduce it. It's one thing to stand up for one's security, and 9/11, as I said, was a crime against humanity in Nuremberg terms. But our response to 9/11, our threatening to invade various other countries, alienating most of the European countries who were solidly behind us, as was most of the world.
But let's bring this to the psychology here and pull Ralph into this, because
okay,
you're hearing him. As I read your articles and your book, you might well say, well, this Ralph is caught in the superpower syndrome. He's ready to see this in the terms the president is. Ralph says, hey, I'm pragmatic. I'm offended. I want a moral leader. You're saying, as I read you, Robert J. Lifton, Ralph's part of the apocalyptic bandwagon here.
Well, he's falling into the point of view that we have to dominate the world and that we have to set the tone for everything in the world. And ironically, this makes us weaker rather than stronger and creates more opposition to us. You know, it's our illusion that we can control human history. And that's what this administration is trying to do. If you read their national security strategy document of September 2002.
Outlining preemptive war and so on.
Outlining preemptive war, but also making very clear that we have to be the dominant power in every region of the world and that no other country or combination of countries should even imagine that it can equal us in power.
Now, that's put forward as a cool, calm, national interest decision. You're saying, no, this is where the apocalyptic element comes
that's
in?
That's right, because it's really a way of saying that we have to, with our military dominance, rule the world and really influence historical outcomes. And, you know, it can't be done. No less than Henry Kissinger once wrote critically about the quest for absolute security. He was talking about revolutionaries, but he said absolute security renders someone else insecure and creates violence. Well, we're seeking absolute security through absolute dominance. It doesn't work.
Randall Kennedy, these are big phrases, control of history, absolute dominance. How do you see it?
I wanted to ask about this notion of control of history. Why, as individuals and as, you know, with respect to institutions, nation states, what's wrong with trying to control the trajectory of one's destiny?
Is this like the sheriff coming into the Wild West?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know about the sheriff, but I don't quite see the critique which says that it's a problem to try to control one's destiny. Why shouldn't the United States of America, viewing a variety of possible outcomes, try to put its weight behind the outcome that it sees as being preferable for itself and the world?
Robert J. Lifton.
Well, it is doing exactly that. The difficulty is that our way, this administration's way of seeking to control its destiny, is on the lookout for terrorists everywhere in the world, and controlling our destiny comes out to control everyone else's destiny. So we threaten other countries, we say that we're sending a message, and they had better do it the way we say it has to be done. Otherwise, they're prone to some sort of attack or pressure that we can exert as the world's most powerful country. It's one thing to control one's own destiny or seek to. It's another thing to control the outcome of everyone else's destiny in order to render one's own destiny absolutely safe, and also to remake these other countries. You know, the plan to invade Iraq began not in the last year, but about 10 years ago, with documents put forward about American hegemony mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. world. Mm-hmm. And September 11th was a release of that plan and rendered it more possible to carry through. So Iraq was invaded not because simply the fear of weapons of mass destruction or for regime change or to democratize the Middle East, but because it was a very important spot in the Middle East in terms of our overall effort at world control.
But the fascinating thing here is you're saying, Robert J. Lifton, that only a superpower would conceive of the notion of controlling history, would concede of the notion of absolute dominance globally. If you're not a superpower, you can't even begin to imagine that.
That's right. Only a superpower could conceive of this, and more so now than in the past. I mean, great empires, Roman Empire, even the British Empire, tried to control much of the world, but there wasn't the kind of technology, especially weapons technology, but other forms of communications technology, that could enable one to imagine controlling destiny of the world.
But the odd thing is, as I read you, the psychiatrist, the man looking at psychology, are saying, ultimately, this doesn't bring comfort because setting the bar, the ambition so high to what you describe as an impossible goal means there's always this fear that somehow that invulnerability, that triumph will never be reached.
I call it being on a treadmill. You keep on struggling for omnipotence. It can never be achieved. Or another image, Sisyphus with bombs. Sisyphus, you know, was condemned.
Rolling the stone up the hill.
Up the hill of Hades, and he could never get it up to the top. So we're a little bit that way about absolute control, about omnipotence, and it's a dangerous game.
And yet there are people out there with bombs, with their own apocalyptic view.
There are
indeed. We don't want to be on the receiving end of. Karen is calling from Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Dr. Lifton. On a much smaller scale, I was involved in a religious cult for 6 years of my life, and I'd like you to address the issues of the dynamics of coercion, persuasion, and mind control, because I see a concern in this country based on the fundamentalist Christian views and the push of fear by our administration that we are heading for self-destruction. In what's going on in the world today. Could you please address that?
Karen, before we get that answer, give us your sense of where you see that. How do you see that?
I'll tell you, like I said, I was following a cult and a group leader for 6 years, And a lot of that had to do with mind control and why there were, I had to get be kidnapped and deprogrammed to get out. And now what I'm seeing in the world and in our country specifically is that people are leaning toward a sheep mentality where they are just following the leader and what is being said to them is being believed. And not to bring it to too much of an extreme, but it concerns me coming back to the days of Hitler and what happened in Germany in another way is happening here.
But you're relating it also to your own recent experience. Robert J. Lifton.
It's a large question, and I've done a lot of work on what I call totalism, all-or-none convictions and moral claims. And the difficulty with totalism is that it asserts the right for what I call dispensing of existence. If you have a totalistic belief system and you believe that your group is absolutely good and others that oppose it are absolutely evil, then you can resort to almost anything. It may be just trying to disown someone else, or that dispensing of existence may take literal form of even killing that person. I came to these ideas while studying Chinese communist thought reform, what's called brainwashing, mm-hmm. a word that doesn't have much meaning. But thought reform was a real process in which there was a systematic method of criticism and self-criticism and confession and a whole series of pressures. So there can be thought reform-like processes in some cults, or there can be people drawn to this totalism without being put through this kind of mind control because they want something absolute.
Do you see echoes of that, then, in the American conversation today?
I see a lot of echoes of that totalism in the American conversation today, and I see impulses toward totalism coming from the White House and the group in power.
Where do you see them? How? Give us an example.
Well, for instance, in their approach to the world and polarizing the world or the axis of evil and seeing themselves and the war on terrorism as representing absolute good and the terrorists themselves as representing evil. And Bush has said, as you paraphrased him, yes, to get rid of individual terrorists is ridding the world of evil. Bush even has, as Woodward also describes, pictures of the leading terrorists of the world, and he crosses them out when they're captured or killed. It's the idea that there's a certain amount of evil in the world, and when you kill the evil people, then you get rid of the evil. And all this is then consistent with the kind of absolutism and the kind of totalism that the caller is concerned about.
So as a psychiatrist, then, you're saying to Americans tonight, watch out, you may be in the grip of something you don't fully understand here.
Yeah, and incidentally, it doesn't have to be a psychosis in the sense of being, I know you're using the term as some kind of aberration. It isn't madness. It's an ideological extremity in which ordinary people can be drawn in. None of our leaders are insane. Rather, they're drawn to a kind of totalistic ideological approach. And that's it's the people who are sane who are more dangerous when they are in the grips of ideological extremism.
Karen, thanks for your call. John is calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I wanted to offer a different characterization of what's going on with Bush and the American military. And
good. Let's hear it.
And that is to characterize it not as an attempt to achieve hegemony over the world, but rather an attempt to act as a police force. Ideally, the police force would be a United Nations where there's general agreement on at least some basic set of rules which the peoples of the world would follow in order not to harm each other.
Right.
Perhaps not to harm those within their own country.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly Bush initially attempted to get a much larger coalition together to get the support of the United Nations. And I guess that failing to do that, you might say that rather than a policeman, vigilante.
But in both cases, you're seeing it as justified as a necessary step to kind of clean up a bad situation?
But not with the end purpose of achieving control.
John, thanks for your call. Your line's a little rough. I'm going to let you go, but we've got the question. Robert J. Lifton.
Well, you know, the reason why the Bush administration did not achieve a kind of United Nations consensus for invading Iraq is that it's against the United Nations rules and policies to invade another country. Yes,
but the U.S. government pointed out all the ways in which Iraq was putatively in violation of rules, and most of the U.N. agreed on those violations.
Yes, it was.
It was only the invasion that they didn't agree on.
Well, that's right, because there were the violations of resolutions that were loud and clear. There's no doubt about it with Iraq. There are other countries that have violated also these resolutions, but the Europeans felt, by and large, at least the Germans and French and Russians, that the inspections were more or less working in terms of weapons of mass destruction. And that seems to have been borne out by their absence and by their being got rid of earlier on through those inspections. So the Europeans did not feel that there was anything in world law that enabled would conclude that America had the right or any country to invade Iraq on that basis. And the effort was to somehow deal with Iraq's violations with minimum violence. That's what we refused to do. We applied maximum violence.
And you're saying that wasn't by accident. That's of a piece with your theory of what's going on here.
Well, all the evidence now, it's not just I'm saying, all the evidence now is that the impulse to invade Iraq was at least 10 years old, and the administration was determined to invade Iraq no matter what came out.
Are you saying then that even the apocalyptic impulse was 10 years old, that it so long predated 9/11, or that was simply a kind buckling up the fringes of control, of dominance?
Some of the apocalyptic impulse is very old, and, you know, we have all sorts of apocalyptic tendencies in our history. Regeneration through violence, as Richard Slotkin has written informatively about, from the early Puritan times. But this particular administration has made this a kind of modus vivendi. So it didn't originate the apocalyptic impulse, but it's brought it into play. And the apocalyptic impulse has to be seen as affecting all these other situations. Mm. Now, of course, one thing I've learned psychologically is that groups and individuals have many-sidedness. You can be pragmatic at some times. You can be in the grip of the superpower syndrome at other times. And you can have apocalyptic impulses at some times as well. And they can all combine. And they do.
Randall, John calls and he says, look, there's police work that needs doing here, and the UN wasn't going to do it, and we had to step up and do it. Robert J. Lifton says, A, the UN wasn't going to do it because it didn't meet the criteria, and B, there's still the apocalyptic underlying dynamic.
I think that the caller had a good point, and I'm a little, I'm skeptical about the evidence for the apocalyptic imagination that's being talked about. Much of the evidence relies upon rhetoric in political speeches, but of course, when leaders are girding people to risk their lives, when you're trying to sort of mobilize public opinion to unleash lethal force throughout the ages, people use a language which is big on moralism. It paints, you know, we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. I don't see this as being so different than what's normally the case, frankly, in a wartime situation,
We'll come back and pick that up in just a minute. Randall Kennedy, Robert J. Lifton, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the superpower syndrome and one psychiatrist's warning of a new American urge to apocalypse. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with distinguished psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton. His new book is Superpower Syndrome, America's Apocalyptic Confrontation with the World. You can join our conversation when you put post-9/11 America on the couch. What do you hear? What do you see? Is Washington now at risk of destroying the world in order to save it? Or is Lifton's diagnosis too sweeping? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mary's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My view of what our response was after 9/11 and the terrible tragedy of 9/11 was that we seem to be an adolescent in a world of elders, and that we responded as if our adolescent feeling of invulnerability had been shattered, and now we were taking on the role of adolescent bully.
But when one of those elders, when one of those older old guys was Osama bin Laden, what should the U.S. be doing, Mary?
I guess what I would hope we could do is look back and take first of all, develop a bigger capacity for some ambiguity and a bigger capacity for some reflection and see if perhaps some of our own behaviors, how have we contributed to this? We have in some part trained Osama bin Laden in some of the activities that he then carried to a purpose that we didn't agree with,
and maybe very materially in Afghanistan. Mary, these are good words that you're raising, and thanks for calling, Robert J. Lifton. Two things there. First, to Randall Kennedy's point before the break, that he feels you basing your diagnosis on political rhetoric. Isn't political rhetoric always hot in time of war and attack? And secondly, this will take us toward your path through this. Mary says we need to have a greater comfort, I guess, with ambiguity. Address those.
Well, first, I'm surprised at Randall Kennedy's kindness toward the administration, because, you know, it wasn't just rhetoric because we're at war. We're at war because we wanted the war, and we use rhetoric to get to the war, and we use rhetoric in the middle of the war. And this administration went along with falsified documents about ostensible nuclear weapons development that turned out to be totally false in Iraq, and was determined to have this war.
But still, 9/11 happened in the Civil War. The
absolutely.
Americans saying we're trampling out the vineyards where the grapes of wrath are stored. That sounds apocalyptic.
Yes, it was. It is. Well, I agree with the caller here that yes, I mean 9/11 was a dreadful event, and how to respond wisely to that. You have to use some kind of force in responding to 9/11, and I certainly agreed with that. One wants to use minimum force and get directly at the terrorists. Calling it a war against terrorism was a mistake from the very beginning. It was a war without beginning or end, without any limit in time or place. So the war itself could readily take on apocalyptic dimensions. But there had to be a response. And I agree with the caller also that and the last part of my book is about stepping out of the syndrome.
Help us step through it. If we accept your framing for a moment, how would the nation step out of this superpower syndrome?
Well, one has to be a little self-critical, and in the end, one has to use political means. I'm using a kind of psychological perspective, but it obviously deals with political and historical questions. So one might want, well, to change the administration or change the leadership, and one would want to elect leaders who would see the world as more complex.
So that's a very practical political step, but if the country is, again, in your view, in the thrall of this, that may not happen. But you're saying, Mary used the word ambiguity. You're saying if the country looks to stamp out all evil, that means infinite war.
That's right. And I think there's a lot of uneasiness in the country. In a way, it's been interrupted by the dramatic capture of Saddam Hussein. But there's a lot of uneasiness about American deaths in Iraq and a steady drumbeat that we get of daily deaths in Iraq. And that psychologically has profound impact because you have to have some sort of survivor meaning for those deaths. And the traditional meaning is we reassert the necessity of the war so the deaths were not in vain.
Our time is very short. I want to ask you, when the opponent is apocalyptic, as you clearly say that Osama bin Laden and the Islamists are, at least his group, then what's the path?
Well,
they are bent on the same thing.
Yes, what you want to do is isolate the opponent. You can't sit down with bin Laden at a table. He won't talk to you. He wants to kill. There's no doubt about it. But if you simply kill in random, diffuse fashion oneself, then one is feeding him. I think there was no one more delighted by our invasion of Iraq than bin Laden. In terms of the contretemps and the potential for the holy war in Iraq and more terrorism.
So the way out, if you were the head of the country, is to say, settle down, there's ambiguity, we're going to go after these terrorists in a more police-style fashion, but let's not look at this as a great battle between light and darkness that must end in one ultimate victory or loss.
You said it better than I could.
Well, I'm sure that's not true. We're out of time. It's been great to have you. Robert J. Lifton, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Robert J. Lifton, visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and author of Superpower Syndrome, America's Apocalyptic Confrontation with the World. Randall Kennedy, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, On Point's movie maven looks at the Civil War on the big screen. This is On Point. The holidays are almost here, and Hollywood is rolling out its lineup of studio heavy hitters and Oscar hopefuls. This year, it's the gritty war epic that's dominating the holidays' big film season, with Master and Commander, The Lord of the Rings, The Last Samurai, and, slated to open Christmas Day, the Civil War epic, Cold Mountain.
So much time has passed since you left, and no word from you. Are you alive? I pray to God you are. Come back to me. Come back to Cold Mountain.
In fact, Hollywood hasn't made a mountain of movies about the American Civil War, but those it has made have included some unforgettable American classics. On Point's movie maven, Garen Daly, joins me now with a look at the Civil War on the big screen. Welcome, Garen.
Hi, Tom.
So have you seen Cold Mountain? It's not out yet, but you're probably on top of it.
Yes, I am on top of it, and yes, I did see it. And I have to say that I was expecting not a lot, and I was very pleased. Very well done. We just found out that it's got 8 Golden Globe nominations, so it's being well received by the critics, and I think audiences are going to love the romance that exists within this film.
So we've got Jude Law, Nicole Kidman, Renee Zellweger, and this is the story of Inman, a Southern soldier who's making his way back to Cold Mountain, North Carolina. His love has called him back in the final days of the Civil War.
That is right. And it's based on the Charles Frazier novel that was very well received by people. And, you know, it's interesting. When I started thinking about Cold Mountain and Civil War films, I realized there's not a lot of films about the Civil War out there.
Compared to World War II, the Vietnam War, all the rest.
All the rest of the wars. I mean, and you can start naming them on your hand. I mean, you think about it, the very first narrative film that we recognize as a masterpiece is Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith's version of what the Civil War was about and what Southern living was about. And then there's also the 1927 Buster Keaton film, The General. Mm-hmm. Again, a very romanticized vision of what the South was all about. And I think at that point, we were looking back 50 and 60 years back to the Civil War with a kind of sense of loss of this wonderful pastoral agrarian society that had been somehow rent asunder by the big mechanical industrial North. And you see that in Birth of a Nation. And again, you see that also with Gone with the Wind, another great classic film where, you know, there is a society that is going to be destroyed, the Southern society. And in the film, you have Rhett Butler meeting and debating with all the Southern gentlemen, talking about the fact that the South is going to face something they're not prepared to do.
Mr. Butler's been up north, I hear. Don't you agree with us, Mr. Butler?
I think it's hard winning a war with words, gentlemen.
What do you mean, sir?
I mean, Mr. Hamilton, there's not a cannon factory in the whole South.
What difference does that make, sir, to a gentleman?
I'm afraid it's going to make a great deal of difference to a great many gentlemen, sir.
Are you hinting, Mr. Butler, that the Yankees can lick us?
No, I'm not hinting. I'm saying very plainly that the Yankees are better equipped than we. They've got factories, shipyards, coal mines, and a fleet to bottle up our harbors and starve us to death. All we've got is cotton and slaves and arrogance.
Gone with the Wind from 1939. So, Garen, you're saying you walked out of Cold Mountain in 2003 thinking about this arc of Civil War films, not so very many of them, and the way in which the depiction of the war has evolved in those films. Where is Gone with the Wind in that arc?
That is actually at the top, because I think Hollywood did was take that vision of the South and that confusion that we seem to have within our own society about what the war was really about and kind of glossed over it and made it into a romantic vision. And at the very top of Hollywood's power, which was 1939, Gone with the Wind comes out, sweeps the Oscars, and becomes the biggest blockbuster of its time.
And when you say the top of the arc there, you're meaning like the most glossed up, the most high, I don't know, what is it, high romance, high historical romance treatment of it?
That's exactly what I mean, because right after that, we go into World War II, and in 1951, John Huston directs The Red Badge of Courage, mm-hmm. based on the Stephen Crane novel. a minor classic in my estimation, but Annie Murphy, a hero from World War II, most decorated veteran, plays a soldier confronting the confusion of war and confronting his own cowardice. So we're starting to slide down, not from romanticism, but to reality. And again, it's picked up later by Kevin Costner in Dances with Wolves, where you find ourselves facing a soldier who is facing the loss of a foot. And in
this is the opening scene of the film. They're about to saw his foot off.
It's the establishing scene, and it sets everything else that happens in Dances with Wolves. The doctors are talking. You don't see their faces. They're dehumanized. You just see their torsos covered with blood as they discuss coldly what they're going to do to this young man.
Is this the last one?
I don't know. There's no ether either.
Jesus Christ.
You there! Is this the last one?
God, what a mess. At least there's no gangrene.
Well, there will be if it doesn't come off soon.
Well, I can't saw if I can't keep my eyes open. I'm sorry. Let's coffee up. He can wait a few minutes.
Dances with Wolves, 1990. We don't think of it as a Civil War film, but it sure begins there. It's all about gore, is about ready to saw his foot off. But yet, Garen, there's still plenty of romance here. He gets right up off that gurney and makes this heroic charge across the field. It's gory, but it's also courage, drama, romance.
Well, it's, of course. I mean, Hollywood needs and thrives on that. But again, you don't see a gory scene in The General or Birth of a Nation or Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. We see a descent coming down from that high idealism to realism. And again, think about the movie Glory, the Denzel Washington mm-hmm. Oscar winner directed by Ed Zwick. There is a film which the core of that is that black men are becoming no longer slaves. They're becoming men. And that's a major thrust of that. So there's a Civil War film that deals with our political reality going on at that time.
So where does Cold Mountain bring us in this arc?
I think Cold Mountain is kind of a post 9/11 response to it. Again, it's 2 years after 9/11, and we're dealing with these very personal stories.
So it starts with real violence at the beginning of Cold Mountain?
It starts with real intense violence, and then what it shifts into the impact of the war on individual people, in particular Nicole Kidman as Ada, who is lost all by herself on a farm, and she needs help.
You got a horse? I can plow all day. I'm a worker, number two. Ain't no man better than me, because there ain't no man around who ain't old or full of mischief. I know your plot. I ain't looking for money. I never cared for it, and now it ain't worth nothing. I expect to board and eat. And I don't expect to work whilst you sit around and watch, neither.
Right.
Is that a yes or a no?
There's a rooster. He's a devil, I'm sure, but I go near him and he is at me with his spurs. He's Lucifer himself.
I despise a flogging rooster.
Oh, no, I wouldn't.
My name's Ruth Hughes. I know your name. Let's put him in a pot.
Renee Zellweger as Ruby laying down the law there with Nicole Kidman, who's playing Ada. In the end, is this a war story or a love story, Gary?
It's more of a love story rather than a war story. The war story frames it. The war story is what changes everyone and compresses their emotions.
What are you predicting for Cold Mountain? 8 Golden Globe nominations today. Anthony Minghella is no stranger to awards. Charles Frazier, of course, wrote the novel, which was big. Is this going to be a big film?
This is going to be a big film. I think that women are going to love it because they're going to get a good cry out of it, and guys are going to like the action and the honor that exists with Jude Law trying to get back to his Ada.
Plenty of foreign actors here in this all-American Civil War film. Nicole Kidman, of course, from Australia. Jude Law from the UK.
And you've got Natalie Portman from Israel. You've got Brendan Gleeson from Ireland. And it's got a great cast.
Well, from all around the world for one Civil War in this country. Cold Mountain. Garen Daly, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Garen Daly is On Point's movie maven. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.